Welcome to the Surviving Grief Podcast, hosted by our grief ministry leaders at Crossroads Church. We'll be sitting down with friends as they share their powerful stories of loss and healing, and we'll hear from grief professionals and other wise people with useful tools for our own time of grief. If you're supporting someone who's grieving, you'll learn how to comfort them and walk with them on their own path to healing. Let's join the conversation.
Well, Katie, here we are.
Here we are.
So what I want you to do is I want you to take me back and I want you to kind of give me context on your family, right? Like of your relationship with your brother and kind of like set the scene. So we're not just starting from loss, but like tell me a little bit about what was happening in life prior to things changing.
Okay. Yeah. So we were raised here in Cincinnati. We were raised Catholic and set a great foundation for our faith. And as we grew into adults, we all left that in kind of searching for our own thing. I found Crossroads and found a relationship with God, which got baptized. It was just a couple years into that. My brother wasn't really a churchgoer, didn't really pursue anything in that regard, so didn't really know what his faith was. He was an electrician by trade and married. He had two kids, a son when he was 18 years old, so he had a son by another woman, and then a daughter he had with his wife. And him and his wife were a little bit on rocky terms. My mom and I were living together at the time. And so he was coming over on the weekends to stay at the house with us with both of the kids. He would get both kids on the weekends. We noticed some things going on with his behavior, but we weren't sure what was the cause of that. Like, we thought he might be into something, some sort of drugs, but weren't sure exactly what was going on there, because he was doing his electrician thing and he was being a set electrician on movie sets. And so he was kind of doing his own thing. So that is kind of where we were. His son was 8 years old. His daughter was 4 years old. And they were both with us when everything went down. So I can remember we were, it was a Friday evening, Saturday morning, and the weather was just changing. It was in April. This is actually the day before Easter. And I just remember my mom coming into my room in a panic, saying that my brother was unconscious downstairs in the basement bathroom, and she had just gone down there to flip the switch from winter to summer, summer to winter, and found him there and didn't know what to do. And so I said, well, call 911. And so she's calling 911. I'm running down to the basement to find him there, you know, just passed out on the floor. And to me in that moment, I'm like, you don't even think in that moment, right? I tried to splash water on his face. I tried to shake him. I prayed over him. God, please, whatever you can do, you know, please help him. Please help Phil. Please help him get through this. I think if I was honest looking back, I think I knew he was gone in that moment. Very stiff, you know. When the paramedics got there, they kind of moved us out of the way. It had to have been within a couple of seconds or a couple of minutes that they pronounced him dead. And, man, that changed our whole world right there. I didn't know what to do. I knew I felt like I had to be strong for my mom because she was so, you know, gone about it at that moment. And for his kids that were upstairs, you know, sleeping. And I just remember the coroner coming and taking the body away and standing on the front porch with a cup of coffee, just in the surreal moment of what is going on. And so upset and so angry and didn't know what to do. Didn't feel like I could turn towards God. I actually blamed God. I was so angry. I said, why? Why would you take him from his family? Why would you take a dad from his children and him from us, you know? And why now, you know? Why? And it was a heroin overdose, right? We didn't even know he struggled with heroin. It turns out he had a bag down there with like several needles and a supply. He was going out of town for the weekend to do some, being a set electrician on some movie film in Louisville. And so having to, you know, get into his phone and call them and saying he's not coming because he's dead, you know? Oh man, it was just terrible. It was just terrible. So we did, we had to call the family. We had to call my siblings that were out of town, my sister, my other brother. And it's just never easy to share. Share that with people over the phone. And then sitting down and trying to explain to his 8-year-old and his 4-year-old that their dad is gone and never coming back. I think maybe it could have been the hardest thing through this whole process. His son just devastated. You know, that was his, you know, that was his everything. He loved his daddy. His daughter did too. She had just turned 4. So she didn't really understand what was going on. But his son understood what was happening. And just those first few days of like getting pictures together, getting the funeral arrangements, like it was all just such a blur. We had the funeral. And I remember feeling like afterwards, like everyone is going back to their lives. Like everyone is okay. You know, they're okay. They're moving on. And I just felt stuck. I just felt stuck in this place of, I didn't know what to do, right? Like I didn't feel like I could turn towards God because I blamed him for taking Phil away, for, you know, this all-powerful, all-knowing God, and him not stepping in to do anything about it. And yeah, I felt very alone, very isolated. After the funeral, just feeling like I didn't know what to do. Someone had recommended a grief support group here at Crossroads. And so 3 weeks after he passed away is when I started in the grief support group. And I think that is really what changed the trajectory of where I was going. Had I not gone through a grief support group at that time, because I was searching for answers. I was searching so desperately, I would have been making them up, right? I just wanted answers. I wanted to know why this happened. I wanted to know who was to blame. I wanted to know how this could be. You know, how do I continue living knowing that this God that I say I trust and love allowed this to happen? And I learned a lot through that grief support group. I think one of the biggest lessons I took away from that was just understanding that in God's original plan, his original design for humanity, that death was never part of that. And actually, a gentleman that did a sermon here said you can't blame God and need him to save you at the same time. And so I felt like through that journey, I was able to really reconcile and understand that God was not the cause of Phil's death, but that he could use it for something more. And I don't think you see those pieces right away. I certainly didn't. But I did decide to lean into just being raw and authentic and get really nitty gritty with God and share my pains and my feelings and my anger and my hurt. And just through journaling, through reading scripture, through being in the support group, and really being able to process those feelings out. Grief is a very isolating place. And so you can stay stuck in grief for a very long time if you don't choose to pursue help. And I wasn't willing to be with my own thoughts for that long. So that was incredibly helpful for me, of just understanding that that God didn't cause his death, but that he could use it for something good. He could use it for something better. And I didn't see that right away, but what I did start to notice is a deeper, more reliant trust in my relationship with God, knowing that he is ultimate good and that he was going to redeem it. In fact, he already did redeem it when he sent his son Jesus on the cross to die for us, so that this life was not the end of the story. I also very much questioned whether my brother was in heaven, right? He wasn't going to church. He wasn't actively pursuing a relationship with God, to my knowledge. And I really felt, when he passed away, I felt like, oh my gosh, I was too late. Like, I was too late. I didn't invite him enough times to church. I didn't try to get him. You know, I should have, you know, done something more to try to get him into a relationship with this incredible God that I know is all loving. And so I felt a lot of guilt. I felt a lot of guilt around not being able to know that where he was when he passed away. I had a mentor at the time that told me, and this is why you should have people in your life, right? She said, Katie, that's not your job. That was never your job. And it's not our job to speculate what happens to our loved ones after this life. I think if we serve a God that's outside of space and time, who's to say that in the moments leading up to that transition, that they didn't have a conversation to say, hey, son, come on home. Right. I don't know. And that could be me just my hopeful desire there. But I think it's naive to believe that the only thing to believe is that he was not in heaven. And so I struggled with that a little bit. Fast forward a couple years, I guess we were in a fog for 2 years, I would have to say. We were in an absolute fog for 2 years. And fast forward 2 years, we started noticing some addiction behavior with his wife, his widow. And I just started praying about that, if the Lord was leading me to do something to intervene with that. And I felt very strongly like he was. He said, yeah, I want you to intervene. So when I did and I confronted her, I said, hey, you seem to be having some addictive issues. I'm happy to take Cadence, my brother's daughter, while you get well. And she basically said, I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. I remember we went to a Frickers and I drug tested her and she tested clean. And I thought, why in the world would you have me do this, Lord? You know, why would I feel so called to pursue this, and she's clean? But several months later, it turned out I had gotten Cadence, and somebody had called Children's Services on her, and basically told them that Cadence was not in a safe environment anymore. And that person called me. I never talked to that person prior to this. Don't even know how they got my number. And they said, the Lord told me that you're supposed to raise Cadence. And I mean, looking back, it's very reassuring to have that. But I was 26 at the time. I was single. I had no kids. So stepping into that was
different. It was unexpected. It was, Cadence is 6 years old at this time. I think she annoyed me. I annoyed her. We were trying to figure this thing out. I ended up, getting her in my care, and I didn't actually get custody of her until 4 or 5 months later when Children's Services found our case and said, hey, we got to come check on the kid. You know, we missed this case. So I got temporary custody at that point and still waited another year to try and have her mom get the help she needed to get well. And she just wasn't pursuing that. So we went ahead and got custody a year later. And it's very difficult to explain to a little girl why she's not living with her only living parents, but also trusting that that's where the Lord was leading us. And so we walked that out together. I was very honest with her. Kids are smart. You know, we never wanted to take away the truth from them. We told them from the beginning that their dad passed from a heroin overdose. And we told Cadence from the beginning that her mom struggled with drugs, with the same thing that her dad struggled with. And I think it was very important to keep that open communication of truth in her life. It was hard. I mean, it's hard taking on a kid at any point. But she was kind of a wild one. And so she had her own thoughts and behaviors. And I had my own, I was working full time in a career that I was, going up the ranks for. And I did have to take a little bit of a step back when I took her on because I didn't know what I was doing. And I remember thinking, I got her into public school 3 weeks before first grade. And one of my mentors basically sat me down and was like, I don't know why you're not doing everything you can do to get her out of public school. And I said, why? And he said, statistically speaking, kids that, are in that environment that are missing a parent or come from a broken home are statistically, you're setting her up for, not the best outcome. And so I really had to wrestle with that. And at the time, I'm like, I can't afford private school. What am I going to do? I went to a prayer night here at Crossroads, and I went and received prayer from someone. And I didn't really even tell them a lot about what was going on. I mean, I told him that my brother had passed away and I had taken custody of his daughter and that I just needed prayer and some direction. And he started praying and talking to me like, assume you want to send her to private school and you feel like you can't afford it or you don't know how it's going to happen. He just started talking about and praying over all the fears that I had around that. And, I just felt in that moment that like God was connecting with me right there saying, you know what, daughter, I've got you. You didn't take this girl on your own. You took her on because I asked you to. And I'm going to take care of that. I'm going to take care of her and I'm going to take care of you. And that's exactly what happened. We ended up sending her to a private school the very next year. She's been there ever since. And she's just thriving. She really is. She's thriving. You fast forward to 3 years ago, her mom actually did pass away. Her mom got clean for about 4.5 years. She ended up having another daughter that went straight into foster care, and that was the kind of the rock bottom that she needed. And she got clean, and she stayed clean, and she fought every day to be clean for 4.5 years. And then 2020 happened in the pandemic, and I'm not sure all the dynamics, but she passed away from an overdose as well. And so here you have, Cadence, who's now without mom and without dad, and trying to navigate that pain with her all over again. And for me, it was so disorienting because I've been her mother figure, but I've never been her mom, right? And so walking her through that was hard. But again, I had a strong relationship with the Lord from diving in that first time when my brother passed away. So I knew at this point that I could trust that even though this was the worst thing I could imagine happening for her, that the Lord was still going to somehow walk us through it and good was still going to come out of it. And today we have a brilliantly strong 15 and a half year old. You know, people talk about the teenage years and, oh, look out, not with this one. Cadence is the most remarkable teen you will ever meet. So loving, so respectful, so honoring, so tenacious, hardworking child that if you look at her story from the outside, you would think, nope, not going to turn out good. But it's exactly the way that I would envision the Lord would have her life turn out. And I know it's just the beginning for her.
So here we are 12 years?
11 years later.
11 years later. It's been a long time since you've gotten to some of those initial details.
Yeah. Right?
And you talked about standing on the porch and just being mad at God, right? Mm-hmm. And you're already putting up the strong walls, knowing that you have logistics that are going to need your attention. You have phone calls to make. You have a mom that you're trying to support in this. And so that first week, did it really set in that Phil was gone? I mean, what was that like, just that whirlwind?
No, it was, looking back, I mean, it was utter just shock and survival. Shock and survival. How do we get through this? How do we get through the funeral? How do we support the kids? How do we support mom? You know, it's those thoughts. Nothing about Phil actually being gone at that point. You know, almost like he was on a vacation somewhere and we were planning all of this, but it just felt also surreal.
The child component is really difficult to navigate, especially, I mean, let's just say the first month. Do you feel like your grief was on the back burner, or was it just out of sight? Like you're really just more in management mode for paying attention to them, helping them navigate those early feelings?
Yeah, I wouldn't say the grief was on the back burner, but I would say it was put away around them. We wanted to have that authentic communication with them and them understanding what was happening. We were getting them into grief support through Fernside. We were doing a lot of support for them. And then when they go to bed, that's really when the grief starts to hit, right? We start to process, like, what's going on here? What is happening, right? That's where all those, you know, the anger, right? And then, you know, the self-medicating, right? You know, drinking and just like trying to numb out some of that pain and some of that those feelings of just anguish, right? That's kind of where we were that first week or two, or even the first month.
You mentioned that the kids went to Fernside. Were there tools that helped you navigate as kind of a fill-in parent at that time, as they're in the depths of this initial grief journey?
I think for Holden, who was 8 at the time, Fernside actually sent a counselor to his school once a week to meet with him. And he really appreciated that, just being able to have somebody to talk to. I think that's the whole what people need during grief is to talk it out, to not isolate and to have somebody who gets it there to help them process. And so that I feel like is what was helpful for Holden. Cadence, again, she had just turned 4 at the time. So she still really didn't understand that her dad wasn't coming home for a while. Probably that whole first year was back and forth of, he's not coming back.
How did the layers of the unknown addiction, how did those start to play out for you? Because here you are not only grieving your brother, but now you're kind of after the fact sorting through there's addiction to heroin. I mean, and you're kind of like looking back at behaviors you mentioned that just they didn't seem right. Like something was in there, right? That just wasn't sitting right. So what was that like as you're now on the back end trying to put the pieces together?
It made me feel a little bit naive, like maybe we should have known what was going on, you know, because after the fact, finding, you know, the burnt spoons and the paraphernalia and then thinking about him kind of dozing off at odd hours and odd times. But we knew nothing about heroin. I mean, when we thought heroin, we thought homeless person on the street, right? We didn't think about brother who's in school to be an electrician. And yeah, so that was startling to us. I remember doing so much just research on what heroin was even like what people on heroin experienced. And one of the articles that was extremely helpful for me basically said that first decision, it was a choice, but every time after, the addiction just takes over the brain. And I guess it was helpful to understand what he was going through, and then like seeing it in his wife and starting to realize like, oh, this may have been going on longer than we thought.
Let's fast forward to you're 26, instant mom of a then 6-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And you're working, you're on the up for professionally, you're kind of a little bit further down your own grief journey, but now there's just the logistics of being a mom. And for, you know, other people we've talked to who have stepped into this role, the feedback we always hear is that they just had no idea all that went into it. I mean, it's a full-time gig on top of just working, right? Things like jammies and teeth and snacks and naps. And there's just the management of a little person that you don't know about until it's full-time, every day, all day. So what is that transition like for you?
I think it was helpful because my mom and I were living together. So when I took her on full time, I had a support of somebody who actually knew what it was like to raise kids. So kudos to mom that that was there. But like, yeah, taking her to doctor's appointments and, you know, realizing she's getting these ear infections and, oh, she has to have tubes in her ears. And I mean, this was a whole world that I'm like, I didn't even know. I just didn't know, right? After school care programs, right? So because if you work, you know, the school day ends at, a, you know, 3 o'clock and your work day don't end at 3 o'clock. You got to have somewhere for them to go. And so, yeah, it was bizarre. I was working full time. My mom was working full time. And so just the, you know, it really is. It takes a village to raise a kid. That's what mode we were in. We had people who were family members who were out of town who would contribute financially. We would have the people who were in town helping, you know, navigate rides and play dates and just different things that. And then on top of that, it was, you know, it's just a lot of navigating. When it came to her being able to see her brother, her still being able to see her mom, and making sure that we were honoring the relationships that were important to her in her life.
Did you ever have any resentment towards Phil? I mean, because 26, most people are working, they're going out, there's this thriving social life, you're dating, you're traveling, and in a lot of ways, I mean, I'm sure some of that was limited for you. Did you ever have some of those moments of just frustration that you were suddenly an instant mom?
You know, I didn't have any resentment because I felt very clearly that I heard from the Lord that this was what I was supposed to do. And so for me, I just, it just kind of came like, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm just going to do whatever it takes to make sure it gets done. I was angry more so at Phil for allowing this addiction to rob his children of a relationship with him. That to me was where I struggled a lot. And obviously, like I said, you know, doing some research about the addiction helps bring some perspective to what exactly an addict is dealing with. And I don't think we'll ever know, you know, unless we're going through that struggle ourselves. But that's really where I found my maybe anger or resentment. It was towards him and his not getting help, not seeking help, and feeling like we were just too late.
Now being 8 years down the road from when you took full custody of Cadence, you know, I think of the people that are in the same position. They lost someone to an overdose, to an addiction, and now they're raising kids that they didn't think that they would be raising. So whether it's a grandparent who's, you know, they thought they were done, they thought they raised their kids and that's it, a sibling, a single parent, how would you encourage that person who's listening to this, who's in the early stages? They are in the financial strain. They are still in the what is happening with trying to figure out how to raise this child. How would you encourage them at that point as they're just trying to figure out how to navigate it?
I would say, well, one, don't double guess yourself, right? If you felt called to take on this child, it's specifically because that's an assignment for you. So if you took on this child, you will, the resources will come, the people will come. And sometimes that looks like asking and reaching out for help. You know, it's okay to ask people for help, especially when you're taking on a brand new responsibility like a child, and not to feel bad about that, because that's what we're in this for. We're in this to be able to support each other through those struggles. And so not feeling like you have to do it alone. I think that's the biggest advice I would give, is make sure you have a community, or you get into a community of people that you can be supported by as you're taking on this new step.
In the early years that you had Cadence, what did honoring and celebrating Phil look like, whether it's holidays or, you know, birthdays, that kind of stuff? How did that start? And then where is it now?
That's great. So my brother was born on Christmas Day and he died the day before Easter. So holidays are a time of celebration now, but in the beginning, they were just a source of pain. We every year still get a birthday cake for Phil and sing him happy birthday on Christmas. And he, you know, kind of resented being born on Christmas because, you know, you get jibbed on all the presents. It's like, happy Christmas, merry birthday. We have done so many different things over the years. We have written letters and burned them and watched the smoke rise up in the air. We've done paper lanterns where we wrote on the paper lanterns and lit them and let them rise up. We've done balloons where we've written balloons and done balloon releases. So there's a lot of different things. We don't do anything consistently each year besides the birthday song on Christmas. But we do try to honor him in a unique way each year. How that looks now is, generally speaking, we'll just go out to eat and spend time talking with Cadence about memories about her dad. Since she was so young, she doesn't have a lot of those memories stored. We also have a photo album of pictures of her and her mom that we'll go to their favorite restaurant and sit there and have a meal and look through those pictures and just reminisce about
the time we did have and honor the time that we did have with them.
For the people that are supporting someone who is in your situation, they're a friend, they're a coworker. How can they support a new fill-in parent? How can they come alongside as someone is in the depths of figuring this out and navigating their own grief? What were tools or recommendations that you would give to that person?
Someone in a support role, I would say definitely act, like do something, right? Don't ask, what can I do? You know, what looks like help? That person doesn't always know what looks like help, but maybe taking the child out to the park for a couple hours, or just taking them so the primary caregiver can have some time to, you know, go out and have a nice meal, or just some time to relax, right? I would say another thing is resources, maybe getting them a grocery store card, or, you know, going grocery shopping for them so they don't have to go grocery shopping. Just the things that every parent needs to do on a day in, day out basis. But if someone is willing and able to take some of that off of the primary care person's plate, those things to me felt like help. Was that like every Christmas I would have aunts and uncles that would just give us Kroger gift cards, or, you know, to the grocery store, so that they just to say, hey, we see what you're doing. We know it's hard. Here's some support. We'd love to be a part of that.
Yeah. And the freedom of the person who is in the role of not having to dictate what they need, when so often they don't know. And I think that's so important that you hit on the action piece, because when people physically come alongside you and they just step in the gap, that not only the resources, but being seen.
Yeah.
That's so huge.
It feels like love. It feels like the hands and feet of Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. Saying you are not alone.
Mm-hmm. And I want to touch on something that you mentioned earlier of just people in grief, that they need to talk about it, right? They need to have opportunities to share about it. And I think the same is probably true if you're stepping into that role as a new parent, especially if you're in a single parent role now, because you don't have necessarily other people that you can bounce off just the minutiae of what is happening day to day as you're figuring it out. We don't always make the right decisions as we're learning, you know, we're kind of learning together with them. And so having someone come alongside who's willing to just listen, especially, you know, again, I keep going back to you as a 26-year-old and your 26-year-old friends, right?
Yeah.
who are like, I don't know what to do either,
right.
But I'm going to listen. And, you know, we're going to Google some things together. We're going to figure out these doctor's appointments. We're going to do it.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
I mean, dude, I have to imagine that even like your time management skills had to change, like calendars are suddenly, you got a Rolodex next to you.
Listen, I was such a go with the flow type of person. I still am to some degree. But when Cadence came along, I had never had so much structure that I implemented just for strict survival, right? Like just so that we could, you know, because I had no idea what I was doing. She, you know, probably caught on to that at some point. Like, you don't know what you're doing, but we're trying to figure this thing out. So we had to get some structure in place pretty quickly, which is kind of counterintuitive to how I felt like I was designed. But, you know, some things you just got to cave on. So the structure, the kids, I did a lot of reading when I first got her on kids and just trying to understand this whole parent thing, right? And one of the things that stuck out to me was kids thrive in a structured environment. And I thought, she ain't gonna survive if I don't put some structure in place. And so just doing the work of what am I doing now, right? Mm-hmm. And how do I do this well?
Gosh, and even, you know, for our people that are in that really difficult learning curve whilst grieving, mm-hmm. there's two just massive life changes that are happening at once. This opportunity for grace in the process.
Yes.
because things are going to go wrong. You're going to put the diaper on wrong, right? You're going to miss the drop off. Like, things are going to happen, and it can just feel like you can't take one more thing. You can't take one more thing that's going wrong. And yet, I just want to encourage those people that, like, it's all right. We're going to let that diaper be wrong here and there. You know, you'll look back and smile about it. And I'm sure that you have some of those things that you look back and you're like, oh man, now that you have a young, we both have young children. Yeah. And so they're even now when I feel like I have all my faculties about me, things go sideways often. So for you, were there things that you look back now? You're like, I had no idea. I mean, the doctor's appointments for sure were top of the list, but what else?
Oh, I mean, I would take Cadence to school when they didn't have school. I would not take her when they did. I trying to keep those things organized. We would get like, I felt like 15 emails a day from her school. And I'm like, how do you navigate all of this? I had room moms, you know, the ones that are real organized. They would reach out to me via text message and let me know when things were due or what things were happening, because they knew, like, I was trying to, you know, be as structured as I could, but just wasn't getting it. Also, I just practiced the habit of apologizing. You know, if I lost my cool because I'm dealing with a 6-year-old I've never had to deal with before and kind of blow up, I had to have a regular practice of going to her and saying, look, I'm sorry how I handled that. I could have handled that better. It's not right for me to raise my voice at you because of how I'm feeling. And I think she appreciates that now that she's a teenager. I think we really have a really good relationship because she felt like I wanted to honor and respect her as an individual through that parenting process while knowing that I didn't actually know what I was doing. So I think that was really important to our relationship.
How do you feel like your faith has transformed? I mean, you talked about some of the maturing and some of the deepening of the faith going through the grief group and kind of struggling with some of those questions. What is it like now, 11 years later, because you have worked with other people who have gone through grief, you're further down the road in your own healing. What's one kind of big transformation that you've seen in your faith?
I think the biggest transformation for me is knowing that the one question God is always asking me is, do you trust me? And my daily response of yes. No matter what's happening in my life, no matter what's going on, no matter what comes my way, it's, you know, life is going to happen. It happens to all of us. We don't get to escape it. But to have a real connection with God, knowing I can answer yes to that question, that's what's the biggest difference. Prior to experiencing grief of any kind, I would say I just had a very naive faith. I loved God. God loved me. You know, we were doing this thing. And going through something as horrific as losing a loved one, especially since we weren't even designed to experience that pain. And coming out the other side, being able to trust that God is going to use it. And you might not see that right away, right? You might not see how he's using this for good. It might not be as blatant as you're taking on a child, right? But he is weaving things throughout that grief journey for that person's good. And he did it in my life. And I know he's doing it in every single person that is going through that journey too. We just have to be tuned into looking at that. And I know it's very hard to do when you're first going through grief. You're not asking, how is this working for the good of all, right? You're not asking that. Neither was I. But you will cut to a point where you start seeing some things, a through line coming together of a story of good that God's telling. And for me, I think it's very rewarding to see people who
are willing to dive into that grief journey and see them come out, not the other side, but after some time has passed, and really see how much good comes from just a really awful period of time in someone's life.
What does good grief look like to you now?
You know, good grief is messy, you know? It's willing to face those emotions that you maybe never thought were in you, and being able to go through that journey of grief and come out a better version of who you were. And although we would want our loved ones back in a heartbeat, I would give it all back, right? If I could have that relationship with my brother. And at the same time, I wouldn't be who I was today without going through that journey. And so it's a journey. And I would say dive in, because it is good.
Surviving Grief is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio. If you'd like to connect or share your own story, reach out to us at podcasts@crossroads.net. We'll see you next time.